encouraged by it. And Keith did a great job in the songs that he picked out. One of the most frustrating things to a speaker is not being able to speak. I'm hoping tomorrow my voice is going to be a lot better. I think I can get through tonight. Tonight I want to talk about what unbelievers believe. I think that's the logical starting point for any discussion on competing worldviews. We're living in an age that, according to Chuck Colson, has the smell of sunset about it. There are things that make us think we're winding down, that our time is running out. Things we thought were nailed down are coming loose on almost a daily basis. The world we live in now is nothing like the world I was born into and grew up in. And we didn't get this way overnight. This has been coming on for a long time. It started at least four centuries ago, when in the 18th century, the Bible was killed. And what I mean is that in the 18th century in this country, and I'm speaking only about this country, the leading political thinkers, philosophers, for the most part, were men known as deists. Deism is a philosophy that believes there is a God, but it does not believe that God has revealed himself in a specific way to man. Deists believe that God has revealed himself in his works, not in his words. Founding fathers like Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington to an extent. These men were not Christian, but they were deists. And that's why in the Declaration, for instance, we read terms about, we hold these truths to be self-evident. We don't need a special revelation to know that all men are created equal. We can deduce that simply by looking at nature and determining from our investigation of nature the kind of God that nature's God is. And we have done that and have determined that all men are created equal. The Declaration talks about nature's God. And what the deists did was, in essence, kill the Bible. The Jefferson Bible, there's a document called the Jefferson Bible, in which Thomas Jefferson went through the Bible and literally took a pair of scissors and cut out every miraculous reference in the New Testament. And what was left was the moral teachings of Christ and the apostles. And he said, this is all we need. We don't need any miraculous supernatural references in the Bible. So in the 18th century, the Bible was killed. In the 19th century, God was killed. In the 19th century, there were men like Nietzsche, the Austrian philosopher, who, when he looked at nature, did not see nature's God. He saw a situation in which might made right. Men like him and Darwin saw the survival of the fittest. And it was Nietzsche who, in his book, Freiliche Wissenschaft, the Joyful Science, coined the phrase that God is dead. We've killed God. God is dead. That was in the 19th century. And in that philosophical thought, the only rule of right and wrong became the survival of the fittest. Might did make right. If you were strong enough to enforce your ideas on your neighbors, you were the one who set the rules. There was a little Austrian house painter who read Nietzsche, believed Nietzsche. Nietzsche spoke about man becoming a superman, able to create his own values, his own morals, decided that he was a superman in that sense, that he could create a society that reflected his values. And as a result of man being, as a result of the Bible being killed in the 18th century, God being killed in the 19th century, man was killed in the 20th century. Did you know that there was greater destruction of man by his fellows in the 20th century than in all of recorded history put together up to that time? To talk about the slaughters of the two world wars, to talk about the dictators like Lenin, Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, to talk about abortion, there was greater violence perpetrated on man by his fellows in the 20th century than had ever been, and that has continued to this present hour. What was the case in the 20th century is now becoming the case in the 21st. I read just last week that anybody who opposes abortion, there is something wrong with them. We're going to be defined before very long as having some sort of mental disability if we have any opposition to the taking of innocent life, human life. When you get rid of the Bible, you get rid of God's specific special revelation. The revelation that imparts worth. Nature does not impart worth to us. God imparts worth to us. And once you destroy the value of man, you can do like Hitler did in talking about men as nothing more than insects. That's the term he used to describe his enemies. That could be exterminated, that could be poisoned, that could be killed to get rid of them if they stood in the way, if they were any problem whatsoever. So it's important that we talk about the things we're talking about this week, and it's important that we understand some things about people who, whether they realize it or not, are advocating the kind of thing that led to the genocide and mass slaughter of the 20th century. Now, the Bible does not promise that Columbia, the gem of the ocean, is going to survive. We have no promise that the gates of hell will not prevail against America. And so I'm not preaching America tonight. I'm not preaching democracy tonight or any night. I'm preaching the kingdom. That's what will survive. And whatever the political situation, the world situation that we have in the future, the kingdom can survive. The faith can survive. The faith can grow. When the gospel was introduced into the world 2,000 years ago, it was introduced into a situation where nobody gave it any chance of surviving. Because the power of God is in the Word. If we'll be true to the Word and preach the Word and live the Word, the faith will survive. Let's start by going to the passage that was read, 1 Peter chapter 3. I understand we have a lot of college students in the audience tonight, and to be entering a situation, an intellectual arena, where your faith is likely going to be challenged in direct and indirect ways is a daunting situation. It can be almost an unnerving situation. And there is a text that was read that is especially for you. And let's look at it again. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 14. Peter says, "But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. Do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and be always ready to give a defense to everyone who asks a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." Verse 14, don't be afraid. When you encounter an unbeliever, here are some of the things you might expect from them. You might expect them to try to make you feel like an idiot. You might expect from them an attempt, if they learn you're a believer, to reduce you to the level of a moron. They try to intimidate. They try to bully. They use technical terms that they have made up to cover up the fact that they really are the emperor's new clothes on display. They have nothing to substantiate their worldview, but they don't want you to look at that. They want you to look at yourself. And what I'm telling you is you have two bases for challenging any unbelief you encounter in college or outside of college or anywhere the rest of your life. Two reasons for challenging them. Number one, you've got a brain just like they've got. Number two, you have access to the same data they have access to. When they tell you they've looked at the data and have added it all up and have drawn the bottom line, and the conclusion is there is no God, you have the right to look at the same data and see if you come to that conclusion. And so don't be afraid of them. What Peter is talking about here in verse 14 is what he heard Christ talk about back in Luke chapter 12, verse 5. Christ says, I'll tell you who to be afraid of. Don't be afraid of the person who can put you in the grave. Be afraid of the person who can put you in hell. And so there is no one you're going to encounter in Bowling Green, Kentucky, that you ought to cower before or fear or be intimidated by. What you ought to do, verse 15, is sanctify the Lord in your heart. You need to determine that God is on the front burner. That God is bigger than anybody you're going to meet up with, anybody you're going to be challenged by in a classroom or outside the classroom. That God is bigger than them, and you need to have a respect for Him that gives you the courage to be willing to answer for your hope. The word translated answer there in the New King James, it is to give a defense, is the Greek word apology. Now, the word apology has changed meaning. Today, the word apology is an admission you've been wrong. Back then, the word apology was an argument that you were right. An apologist was a defense attorney. You've been accused of a crime, you go hire an apologist. Someone who would argue your case. Someone who would argue that, no, you're not wrong at all. You're exactly right. And you need to be willing and ready to present arguments for what you believe. Now let me tell you something about the Greeks. When Peter says we need to be ready to give an answer, he wasn't coming up with something that was brand new in the Mediterranean world at that time. The Greeks, every one of them, educated Greeks, believed that everybody should be willing and ready and capable of giving a rational explanation for what they believe. I mean, it wasn't just Peter saying this. Whether you were a Stoic, whether you were a Gnostic, whether you went along with Plato and his emphasis on reason, or Aristotle and his emphasis on the senses, whatever position you took, whether you were an Epicurean, whatever position you took, they expected you to be able to present reasons why you believed the way you did. In John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Logos. That's translated word. That's a proper translation. In the beginning was the Word. But the Greek word there is Logos, logic, logical. The Greeks took that word Logos and put it into a banking setting. When you deposited money in a bank, you had something to draw on. It's like having a debit card. You go in and buy something, you use your debit card. The way I understand it, and Paula will correct me if I'm wrong, the debit card tells the merchant there is money in your account to cover the charge, and so the transaction is carried out, it's consummated. Well, that's how the Greeks thought philosophically. They thought that no matter what you believed, you ought to have some intellectual capital, money, banked, that you can pull out that would cover your beliefs, that would cover your worldview. Now tonight we're going to be talking about the atheistic worldview. And I'm going to tell you right now, they don't have any money in their account. And they know they don't have any money in their account, and that's why they don't like to talk about their beliefs. To call somebody an unbeliever doesn't mean they don't have any beliefs. They've got more beliefs than I do, and most of them are unbelievable. That's why they don't like to talk about it. I've had two public debates with atheists. In the 1980s, I debated the president of the Central Illinois Association of Atheists, the Madeline O'Hare organization. A couple of years later, I debated Professor John Patterson, professor of thermodynamics at Iowa State University. I could not get either one of those men to talk about what they believed. Because for an atheist to talk about what he believes is to give up the argument, to give up the fight. Nothing exposes the intellectual vacuity, speciousness, stupidity, if you will, of atheism any quicker than to get them to talk about what they believe. We're going to talk about that tonight. Now, at no time, am I suggesting that there are not any difficulties involved in the Christian belief. There are. I've not figured out everything. I come across things in the Bible. I'm not sure how to put them all together. But it's like this. For a few years, I was a certified house inspector, home inspector. People buying a home, they would hire me to go in and look it over and advise them. And when you're in that business, you learn the things that are deal breakers. You don't want to buy this house. And you tell them those things. Here's a deal breaker. If you ever buy a house with a basement, and the basement's built of concrete block, and you go down there, and you see cracks between the blocks, you've all seen them. You know, cracks between the concrete blocks and the mortar there. Now that's unsightly, and you'd rather those cracks not be there, but that's not a deal breaker. You go down to the basement and the cracks are horizontal, not vertical, but horizontal. You get out of that basement before it caves in on you, and you go looking for another house. Horizontal cracks are a deal breaker. Now, my Christian belief may have some vertical cracks that I've not yet wrapped my head around, been able to explain to my satisfaction or to anyone else. But I've not found any horizontal cracks in Christianity. And that's all I've found in atheism, in the atheistic worldview. Compared to the problems the atheist has, whatever problems we believers have doesn't amount to spit on the griddle. And I want to talk about those problems tonight. I'm going to try to make this as easy as I can, especially for those of you who are starting college. I think there are only two things you need to remember in discussion with an atheist. There are only two things you need to ask them about. You need to ask them, what is their eternal existent? You need to ask them to explain the origin of life. If you can remember those two things, and I'm going to go through those here in a minute, the eternal existent and the origin of life, I think you've got all you need to expose the unbelief, the groundless, baseless unbelief of whomever you're talking with. So let's begin by talking about the eternal existent. What do I mean by eternal existent? I mean this. Everybody believes that something has existed forever. Doesn't matter if you're an atheist or a theist. Everybody believes something has existed forever. How can I say that? Well, I can say it this way. Because nobody can imagine how something can come from nothing. If there was ever a moment of time in this cosmos, if I can even use that term, when there was absolute nothing, no time, no space, no matter, nothing, there would be nothing now. You cannot get something from nothing. When Oscar Hammerstein wrote, "Nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever could," man, that guy's a theologian in The Sound of Music. He's exactly right. So everybody believes that something has existed forever. The difference between the atheist and the theist is this. We believe what has existed forever is living. They believe what existed forever was dead. We believe a living God is the eternal existent. The atheist believes that dead matter is the eternal existent. Now, I don't try to comprehend eternity. I mean, I will give myself a migraine and have to go to bed for 2 or 3 days when I try to actually wrap my head around an eternal being. There are some things we just have to accept because there's no other alternative. And the eternal existence is one of them. Something has always existed. So ask them to state, to name, for you in the class or whomever, what they believe has existed throughout eternity. Now, they're going to say dead matter, which leads then to the next question. Life from death. If what existed eternally was dead, no life in it, how did life come to be? How did life appear? Let me tell you a story about the Blue Rose. 1998, I, Pat Hardiman, some other men started a high-tech tone alert radio company. And we built tone alert radios for FEMA, for the Chemical Stockpile Weapons Emergency Preparedness Program. We built hundreds, thousands of radios. And my job in 1998 was to open up our engineering lab down in Huntsville, Alabama. One of my first hires was an engineer by the name of Ricky. Ricky had two masters from MIT, had a bachelor's from the University of Tennessee. Ricky was a great guy, enjoyed being around him. Ricky spent more time messing around with other stuff than doing the work that I hired him to do. But some of the stuff he messed around with was halfway interesting. One of the things Ricky was trying to do was to grow a blue rose. Nature does not produce a blue rose. I didn't know this until I met up with Ricky. Never thought about it. Nature does not produce a blue rose. You know why nature does not produce a blue rose? Because it does not have the blue pigment in its DNA. When you buy a color copier, you get the black cartridge, and then you get 3 color cartridges, one of which is blue. What do they call that? Is that magenta? Cyan. Magenta's red. Yeah. You get 3 cartridges, and there'll be little color dots, blue, red, yellow. Those are the 3 primary colors. You cannot get those colors by mixing any other colors. If you're going to have a blue color, if you got a box of crayons, if you're Bob Ross there on public television painting, yeah, you've seen that show, Bob Ross, he's dead now, but you know, he's got all those paints and he mixes them together, he gets all kinds of colors. If Bob's going to paint a blue sky, he's got to have a tube of blue paint to put on his palette. Because he can't put any other colors on and mix them all around. And there's blue, and I'm going to use that for my sky. Blue is a primary color. And that's why you cannot grow a blue rose. Morning glories have the blue pigment. Petunias, some of them I think have the blue pigment. Other flowers, but not roses. So what Ricky was trying to do, Ricky had gotten permission to go down to the human genetics lab there in Huntsville. And he was a smart guy. He could do this kind of stuff. He had spliced the DNA out of a bacteria that produced a blue pigment. He had spliced that blue DNA out of the bacteria into a white flower DNA, hoping that somehow or other, by taking the blue from the bacteria and putting in into the flower, he'd be able to come up eventually with a blue rose. He never came up with a blue anything. Just doesn't work. If you're going to get something out of something, what you're wanting to get out has to first be in the thing you're working with. You can't get out of a computer what has not been programmed into a computer. Now, what does that have to do with life from death? If the atheist is right that the eternal existent is dead matter, you cannot get life from death. There has never been an experiment performed. There's never been anything seen in nature to suggest how life can come from something that doesn't have any life in it. But that's what the atheist believes. That we started with dead matter, and somehow or other, out of that dead matter, life came. And you point out to them, well, there's no scientific evidence for that. There's no research to back that up. It's certainly contrary to reason. I mean, when the Bible says in the beginning God created, that's the most reasonable, rational statement anyone can make, that life came from life. And so you point out to them there is no basis. You've got nothing in your intellectual bank account, your philosophical bank account, to pay the check you're trying to get me to cash that says life comes from non-life. And here's what they'll say. Oh, that's not true. They'll say, no, we have research that suggests how life can come from non-living. And here's what they may talk about. They don't talk about this as much as they used to. But they will talk about the Stanley Miller experiments performed up at the University of Chicago back in 1953. Stanley Miller had gotten a degree at Cal Berkeley, tried to get into a graduate school, somehow or other ended up at the University of Chicago, studying biogenetics, biophysics, something like that. And while he was at Chicago, and I'm simplifying this from his technical terms, he got him a terrarium, you know, a glass box, a flask. He got him a flask is what he got him. And then he put into that flask what he thought comprised the primeval atmosphere, the primordial soup. He put methane in, he put ammonia in, he put some other things. The one thing he didn't put in was oxygen, because for some reason they knew the experiment would never work if you've got oxygen in the soup. He started boiling water, and then he started inserting electric shocks into the gas. Now, let me say something about this mix of gases he came up with. Pure assumption. He has no idea, nobody has any idea what the primordial soup, a term they made up, consisted of. There wasn't a primordial soup to begin with. But they were just guessing. When he put his original configurations of gases into the flask, he didn't get anything, so he kept tinkering with the quantities and the gases he put in until after he had been shocking the gases for about a week, he got looking in the flask and saw something inside there. And they got it out and they analyzed it. It was a tarry-like substance that they determined were some amino acids. And immediately flashed across the newspaper headlines of the world. Experiment shows how life could come from non-living. How life arose on the planet. And it did no such thing. That was nothing but propaganda. That was nothing but a lie. Amino acids are not living matter. They are dead. It doesn't matter that some amino acids are the building blocks of life. They are dead. Battery acid is not alive. It is dead. How is it that taking dead elements, fiddling with them, and getting another dead element proves how a living element can come from nothing but dead elements? How does that prove when somebody with a mind puts all of this together and mixes it all up and starts shocking it and doing all kinds, how does the activity of a human mind, intelligence, and intellect prove how no mind, no intelligence, no intellect could assemble dead matter and get life? Now that's the kind of duplicity they deal in. That's not honest. Back in the 19th century, when electricity was being introduced and things were happening with electricity, a lot of people back then thought that there was something about electricity. Now, I know we refer to a live wire, but there's nothing living about a live wire. The wire's dead. What's in the wire is dead. Nothing living about it. But people back then thought somehow or other that electricity was the key to explaining how life could arise from non-life. And there was a book written about it. And you've probably seen this book. You know, the scientist assembles a bunch of dead body parts, puts it there on the table, they lift it up in the castle, and it gets zapped. It's alive. It's alive. You know, that science fiction written by Mary Shelley, Baker Shelley, is the best that science has to offer. When a scientist tries to convince anybody how life can come from dead matter, he is delved into science fiction. He is no longer in the realm of science. He is so desperate to come up with some explanation to validate his philosophy, to put some money in his intellectual bank, that he is willing to resort to this sort of dishonesty and subterfuge to make people believe that life can come from non-life. There's never been an experiment, I repeat, there's never been an experiment. There's never been any logical argument presented to show how blue can come from a crayon box that doesn't have blue in it. Or that can show how life can come from that which is not living. That's the best that atheistic science has to offer. Now there's a terrible conclusion that follows from all this, and you, if confronted by an unbelieving instructor, professor, you ought to press this. There's a terrible conclusion that comes from. Namely, if there is no God, there is no meaning in life. Jean-Paul Sartre was an honest atheist. A lot of atheists aren't honest. They want to uphold a philosophy that strips life of any meaning and then act like there's meaning in life. They want you to think there's meaning in their pronouncements. There's meaning in their conclusions. There's meaning in their worldviews when their philosophy denies that. But not Sartre. Sartre was willing to owe up to his atheistic, existentialistic philosophy. He even wrote a book about it called Nausea. In the French, Nausea. And his point was, there is nothing in life that gives meaning to life, not even love. Because if there is no God, if there is no hereafter, if there is no maker, no creator before whom we'll stand to answer for the lives we've lived, the life of the best person in this auditorium is of no more eternal value or worth than the life of Jeffrey Epstein. The life of the best elder you've ever known is of no more worth than the life of Adolf Hitler. Because when they die, they're both dead. And what they've done will soon be forgotten without any lasting consequence. There will be no eternity beyond to enjoy blessing or to face punishment. there is absolutely no meaning in life. Paul recognized that in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, if the dead be not raised, I mean, this is all meaningless. We have no hope. We have no forgiveness. If the dead be not raised, we are of all men most miserable. These people better hope there's a God, because if there isn't, there is no meaning to their existence. Many atheists coming to that conclusion, like Nietzsche, like Sartre, like others, died insane, died madmen, or committed suicide because they couldn't live with the consequences of their philosophy. Now, starting tomorrow night, Lord willing, I'm going to begin constructing the gospel argument for God. I'm not going to be talking about the philosophical, the classical arguments for God that all follow essentially from the law of motion. You know, if a ball is rolling across the field, what's our assumption? Our assumption is somebody kicked it, somebody put the ball in motion. The classical arguments all are sort of developments of that. That's not what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about the gospel argument for God, based on historical eyewitness testimony, the very finest kind of evidence that can be offered in any court, before any jury, and we're going to look at that. Tomorrow night we're going to talk about the credibility of the New Testament. 99% of everything we know about God, everything we believe, comes from the New Testament. Can we trust our New Testaments? That's tomorrow night. After showing that we can trust our New Testament, its historical validity, Tuesday night, God enabling, we look at what this document says, what evidence is presented that leads us to the conclusion that Jesus was raised from the dead. Once we've got Jesus raised from the dead, we've got a basis for a worldview, for a faith, for a perspective on life that makes life worth living, that fills us with joy and fills us with hope and gives us purpose and meaning in life. If you can get back for all that, I'll be happy to see you. God bless you. Thank you for listening tonight. If you've not yet found the peace that's in Christ Jesus, you need to do something about that before you leave, by surrendering yourself to Christ, meeting Him on His terms, accepting the gift of forgiveness that He gives. If you're here and that's your desire and you wish to do something about it now, we invite you to come while together we stand and while we sing.